I'm teaching a medical course here at Stanford. I co-direct a course called Being Mortal. And one of our lecturers did ask if they could live forever, the students, would they want that? And I think the lecturer was a bit surprised that very few of the medical students at least admitted that that would be something that they would even desire to do. No, they were not interested.
Welcome to Peaceful Exit, the podcast where we talk to creatives about death, dying, grief, and also life. I'm Sarah Cavanaugh, and my guest today is Dr. Deborah Cotto, a geriatrician and co-director of the Stanford Center on Longevity at Stanford University. Dr. Cotto has spent her career thinking about what it means not just to live longer, but to live better, and what it looks like when those two things come apart. In this episode, she shares what her earliest patients taught her about the end of life and what any of us can do starting now to age with dignity and purpose. Welcome to Peaceful Exit.
Thank you so much. It's just a pleasure to be here.
You started out caring for HIV and AIDS patients before there was effective treatment options. How did this experience inform your decision to specialize in geriatrics and start thinking about longevity?
Wow, that takes me back quite a few years. That was basically my early medical training. And yes, we didn't even have AZT, which was the first approved medication for HIV/AIDS at that time. So what I had to deal with as a young house officer was be able to help people who I couldn't cure and who, in fact, I lost. One of the most impactful moments of my residency was actually this particular person didn't have HIV/AIDS. He was one of the most kind people. And every day, and he was a bit older, actually. He was one of my older patients. He had had prostate cancer. And he said to me every day I'd see him, and he would say, I want to go home. And then I would say, you require antibiotics through the vein, and we can't at that time give them at home. I need you to stay in the hospital until you finish this course of at least 7 days, and we'll see how you do. And then I'd come back the next day, and I'd say, how are you, Mr. So-and-so? And he would say, I want to go home. He was very clear. I want to go home. So then in my logical mind, I said, I can send you home, but I can't send you home with this treatment. And if you don't have this treatment, then you will pass away because I can't treat your infection that's in your blood. He looked at me very clearly and said, I want to go home. So I said, okay, I've arranged for you to go home today. I remember very clearly at 2 a.m. the next morning, I get a call, a page on my beeper. Back then we had beepers, not phones. And I answered and it said, hello, this is the police department. I'm calling you because there is this patient who has passed away. I need to verify that you were the last doctor who took care of him. I then knew who it was and I verified it. And then his partner came on the phone. And he just thanked me profusely. I had never met this man before in my life. He said, thank you so much. This is exactly what he had wanted. And his dog was with him. And so even though it was tough, I felt very like I did the right thing. Thinking back on it, like sometimes when you go forward, you don't really see these things. But that is a case I remember quite well.
That's such a remarkable story, in part because you saw him as a human being, as a patient, and what he wanted. It seems as if the medical establishment just pushes you to save lives, save lives, save lives. But in this case, you stopped and you saw him and saw his humanity. And it's really beautiful. What were your earliest experiences with death? We heard about your professional experience, but what about personally?
Yeah, so my first major loss was my maternal grandmother when I had just turned 5. I got to spend a lot of time with her. And I don't recall having any recollection of her being ill, but she had ovarian cancer. I never visited her in the hospital, and I did not go to her funeral. Maybe a month after she passed, I became aware of the concept of death. And that I remember very clearly. But another thing I remember from that time, which was amazing, I think I grieved. I had a dream probably around that time where my mother must have been reading me Bed Knobs and Broomsticks or something, but I ended up on a magical bed with a turning handle on the head, and I flew up in the sky, and I got to meet my grandmother.
So your concept of death was this mystical story as a five-year-old. Did you have any lasting impressions of what cancer was?
I think I was very protected. So I heard the word cancer. I didn't appreciate that she was looking sick or getting ill. So I don't think that was any part of my memory. They really, at that time, right? It was.
Yeah, they didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
It's very true. So when people hear about longevity, they often think about living longer. How do you personally define a long life?
Chronological time is, if we're going to say long life, I would define it that way. And fortunately, a baby born today could reasonably expect to have a century-long life, which is really unusual. This is the first time that we're seeing this. That being said, I think we have more than 120,000 centenarians now living in the United States alone. I think of a long life as someone who's reached 100.
And what makes it a good long life?
Interestingly, the centenarians who I've had the privilege of knowing, I think most would say that they've had a good long life, even though as we get older, we just become more heterogeneous. I have people who are completely dependent on someone else for their daily lives, to those who are still living independently and doing the things that they were probably doing when they were 80. I think maybe people who might be listening would say, well, how can a 100-year-old who is essentially bedbound and who has lost so much function and maybe some cognitive function say that they've had a good long life? And I would respond, that really depends on the individual because it's their perception of how their life has been. And I can't judge that.
What have you found tends to matter most to people in their final months or years? And what surprisingly stops mattering?
Sometimes it's a pet at home who means the most. But for a lot of people, if they're lucky enough to have family and friends, I think it comes down to the people who are close to them, that they really want to have that connection with the people they love, who they realize they won't be around for. And I feel that a lot of those people, in a way, some of them want to provide reassurance to those people who they're going to leave behind. But on the other hand, I have other people who very much, I think they still, up until the very end, don't want to acknowledge that they're leaving this world. It's almost like it's not happening and we're not talking about it. And so it's life as usual, talking about maybe goals that they have for the future, even though everybody's looking cross-eyed because they're wondering how are they going to do that if they're confined to this bed with tubes, with this diagnosis, et cetera. So it's just very variable.
So what's the right time to begin thinking about longevity? If someone wants to age well, physically, but also emotionally, socially, spiritually, what should they start doing now, even in their 30s and 40s?
Maybe I should take that little piece from when I was a kid, that realizing that sometimes you don't feel like it, but health behaviors are so important for longevity. I tell my patients who are late 80s, 90s, that if they've been a couch potato their whole life, but they happen to survive, that it's not too late to get up and do something. Because you can still build muscle at any point in life. But if you started earlier, it'll just probably be easier and you might be at a higher level of function. So for instance, studies published back in the late 1990s, where they looked at people who were endurance trained versus sedentary people and something called the VO2 max, which is a measure of fitness. Basically, those who were the highest trained endurance level over time, there was a decline in VO2 max with age. And then same thing with the sedentary people across those same age groups. But over time, those people who are sedentary would have more health consequences. So it's just an idea that the more you put into the bank earlier on, the better you're going to probably be later on.
What kind of goals do you typically recommend patients set as they age? And what everyday habits do you think have the biggest payoff later in life, not just for lifespan, but for dignity and independence at the end?
So with my patients, they have been so different from across a lot of sectors that I generally begin by doing a listening tour to see where their experiences are and then ask them what their goals may be. And it is true, or at least anecdotally, what I recall, when I start asking people over the age of 90 what their goals are, I think I've had more than a chuckle. Like, are you kidding me? Why? What? But I do think that goal setting is important. And so then we have to look where that person is. So some people may have been more active before and just stopped, maybe due to a knee injury, say playing tennis. And so they just really didn't find anything else that they like. They are now whatever age and they're watching TV 4 hours a day. Then it's, can you get out of this chair where we're talking by yourself? Can you get out of the chair without using your arms? And if they can, then I say, that's good, but don't take it for granted, because if you keep doing what you're going to do, that's going to be tougher. And oftentimes couches are kind of cushy. So people will be like, oh yeah, I can't really get up off the couch without some extra help. And so that will be the goal. And I know we have the remotes now and everything, and commercials can be irritating, but literally maybe let them play. And that's when you get up out of the chair and go for a little walk around wherever you are and then come back down just to get up and do something during the day. So a goal can be as simple as that. Other people have more goals. Like, I always wanted to run a half marathon, but I never did it. But now I'm too old. I'd say, really? Are you? Let's see how we could potentially reach that goal. But if they haven't been trained, would recommend if they have the resources to have someone who knows what they're doing to be able to guide them on how to do that safely.
Do you talk to people about stress?
Oh, yeah.
There was an article about blue zones, and it made me think of my mother when she was in her 50s. She was working. All four of her kids had left the home. And she looked at her calendar and every single day had something. 7 days a week, she and my father were very busy. So she instituted what's called a yellow day, because she took a yellow marker, like a highlighter, and she said, at least 2 days a month, we're not going to have anything scheduled. And she would mark it. She would just take that yellow highlighter and put in a couple days a month that there was just nothing, no plan. And so you mentioned someone who's on the couch a lot and sedentary and maybe not able to get off the couch. But what about the other extreme where you're working like full out and really not taking any rest?
To answer your first question, yes, I do talk to people about stress, but often that is in the context of if we're in a, say, doctor-patient relationship and I say, oh, you do these things, they'll be, I have no time. My life is too stressed. It's too full. How am I'm taking care of an elder. I'm taking care of kids. I work a full-time job. And you're telling me to go get some extra physical activity. Exactly when do you expect me to put that in? And so I love your story about your mom realizing that she probably needed some downtime. And I think when you put that at the forefront and think about how can you get there, you can make it happen. But I do remember being a patient myself, a young mother, and my doctor saying, well, your blood pressure is a little high. You know, you look like you're stressed. I'm like, I am stressed. You know, I'm stressed. You need to, why don't you go do some dancing or something? And I remember thinking, how am I supposed to fit that in my day? But I did follow the doctor's advice. And I said, you take care of dinner this night. I'm going to go to this dance class. And it was the best advice that physician for me at that time gave. Okay. So, but thinking about stress now more from a research standpoint, not that I've studied stress specifically, but what I'm aware of is I kind of put it in two different bins. One is stress where we actually do have more agency over our time. Like, we can modify what we do and how we choose to do things, whereas other people have extrinsic stressful things that they can't control. And I think it's that stress that is really debilitating. Those are where the real ill health effects occur.
How do you think connection with family, friends, community, as well as feeling a sense of purpose impacts longevity and your quality of life?
I would say as a species, humans tend to thrive under social connection. There are studies that have shown that socialization will impact longevity in a positive way. To have some external validation of who you are and why you're important, and to be able to spend your time doing things that matter to you in the company of others is extremely powerful.
How should we be shifting the way we think about mortality and longevity as people begin living longer lives than ever before?
I yesterday was sent a slide deck from somebody, and I was reading through it and came across this quote, which I don't know anything about Gilgamesh, but this is the quote that I came across that I thought was really interesting. Is accepting mortality the key to living a meaningful life? And I stopped and I read that quote and I wrote it down because a lot of people who are in this space will say that dying is a part of living. It's a part of the process. It is something that a lot of us in society, we don't want to face because it's so unknown and it's scary. So I wondered if that quote, if people are able to accept that, yes, they too, one day will pass along, will that then help them think about their life in a different way?
It made me think about an interview I had with Mary Roach, and she was talking about scientific innovation that's trying to actually 3D print living tissue. And I was thinking about what happens if we can remake parts of our bodies so that our bodies physically last to 130, 140. I'm just so curious about what that does to our mental health, to our overall well-being. If we're trying to make this sort of meat sack last longer, what she really came out with was the body's such a miracle, the way the systems work, and we have not been able to figure out how to replace all the parts.
Our technology is more powerful than it ever has been. I think there are scientists who are out there today who believe that perhaps there could be some type of immortality achievable. I think we're far away from that now. And I think there are a lot of sociological implications of considering what that might actually look like. I do get the sense, and maybe it's for where I am, but that it's really a minority of people who feel that urge. And that's why they get in the space, is because they really dread the idea of getting older and losing function and passing along. I would say in teaching a medical course here at Stanford, I co-direct a course called Being Mortal. And one of our lecturers did ask if they could live forever, the students, by, I guess, replacing an organ. Would they want that? And I think the lecturer was a bit surprised that very few of the medical students at least admitted that that would be something that they would even desire to do. No, they were not interested.
I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about what you're doing now, including teaching.
Yeah. I'm a co-director of the Center of Longevity, run by Professor Laura Carstensen. At this moment, I'm teaching a course on the undergrad campus that has almost 100 students. It's actually called Longevity and focuses on this idea that a baby born today can live a century-long life, but how we're set up as a society in so many different facets, we're just not well prepared. So we're putting it on the students to try to figure out how can we think about aging societies and really take advantage of the opportunities that we have now that will involve from birth all the way into death. How can we think about education, finances, aligning health spans with lifespans, the fact that work-life balance, like if we think about it now at age 65, we potentially have another 30 plus years to live. Do we stack it all at the end? Why could we not have more flexible work weeks so that we could say, you know what, you need to be... relax and get rid of your stress. Wouldn't that be amazing if you could magically have an extra day during a work week to actually do those things, those kinds of things. So I'm teaching that. I am still applying for grants to further the research in the gut microbiome and aging to better understand the microbiome and how important that is in the mind-gut area, as well as health outcomes and circadian rhythms and things like that. Musculoskeletal aging is still something that is big and close to my heart. And then I am seeing patients a half day to a full day a week in the outpatient setting, currently at the VA.
What kind of advice would you give me as a young person, a young-ish person? I'm 60, I feel young. About bone health, because I already have a diagnosis of osteoporosis, it's right on the line, and recently had cancer treatment where they removed any kind of support for the bones.
So fortunately, in 2026, we have great options. And what I do usually is I go over the health behaviors. So we're talking about feeding your body the proper nutrients, which does not necessarily include supplements in my book. So it's really about getting and making sure, in your case, it would make sense to say, check a 25 hydroxy vitamin D level. Just look at the amount of calcium that you're getting in your diet. If you're already a dairy eater, you probably don't need any extra calcium. We think about 1200 milligrams of calcium a day, because we know calcium and D are important for bones, but not to go crazy about that. It's more about getting enough fresh fruits and vegetables in your daily diet, avoiding processed foods as much as possible. I tell people who are like you and you're saying that coffee is okay. If you want to add milk to your coffee, all the better. Don't add artificial sweetener or creamers in general. I would not suggest that. I think coffee by itself, black, would be better than that. Then I talk about physical activity, and I generally use the physical activity guidelines that have been published since 2018, which are basically 150 minutes a week of walking or moderate activity, and then also 2 days a week of doing muscle strengthening and resistance. And to that, which is not included in the public health service message, is thinking about balance, because 95% of fractures occur because of a fall. So literally, even if your bone density is in the toilet, if you don't fall down, the likelihood of fracture goes down. And then I talk about medications. And the medications, still the number one treatment is a bisphosphonate, which was first FDA approved in the United States in 1995. Its generic name is alendronate. Its trade name is Fosamax. That got a lot of negative press starting about 2008, where everybody thought this was a poisonous drug because it made your bones more brittle. And the reason why they thought that was because there are certain individuals who would develop thigh bone fractures that they call atypical femoral fractures, extremely rare. But fortunately for orthopedic surgeon at Kaiser Southern California, who looked at every single x-ray that came through, found that in particular, Asian females who were thin, who were on this for a lot longer than 5 years, were the ones that were at the highest risk of developing this complication. Since then, the Endocrine Society and other societies have pulled back against, this is not a drug you take forever. It's something that you take for a prescribed period of time. And there have been multiple trials of thousands of women and men, some men, to show that this medication is efficacious with few side effects. And the other reason why I'm focusing on this medicine, by the way, I have no conflicts of interest here with this medicine, is because of all the other medications. And now in 2026, we have multiple medications we can use to treat osteoporosis. And all those other medications, including, let's go back to hormone replacement that could be used, or menopausal hormone therapy really helps protect bone and was shown to prevent fractures. All of those medications, once you stop them, you're going to have a resumption of bone loss, such that a bisphosphonate, if you can tolerate it, or something like alendronate, is what you'd be on. So there's no purpose on going on any of those other medications unless you're ultimately going to be willing to go on this drug, but it should not be forever. And studies out of New Zealand published in the New England Journal of Medicine showed that people who don't even have osteoporosis but have low bone density, those people who just got one injection of a drug called zoledronic acid every 18 months for 4 injections over 6 years had a decreased risk of a fracture. They also had a trend to have less mortality. It's actually a medicine that works and shouldn't be used forever. It has to be dosed appropriately, but I would take it if I needed it. And I think it's been shown, for instance, in cancer survivorship studies to show a benefit of decreased metastases and also overall survival. So, and there are some people who are studying it in terms of in the aging space because people are dying less in these trials over 3 years, which is crazy.
What is the name of the medicine again?
Zoledronic acid. The trade name is Reclast.
Well, thank you for all of that. And I know bone health is kind of your wheelhouse.
Yes, yes.
Clearly your wheelhouse. I'm stepping back just a little bit, sort of a 10,000 foot question. In 2024, the average retirement age for human beings, I'm guessing in the United States, hovered around 63 years old. But many of these folks, obviously, now that we're talking about a 100-year lifespan, have a couple of decades left. Should we be rethinking how early we stop working?
I do think we should be thinking about how we want to spend our time if we're, let's just say, getting to be about that age. Because I think people who stop and then don't have a plan, that's when it becomes really tough to retire. And again, I think it depends on the job. So some people who have jobs that they really love and don't want to stop working and are still contributing meaningfully, I don't feel like they should think that they need to retire around age 63. On the other hand, what if you are doing a physically demanding job and it's just not the same and you actually don't like it, you're using it because it pays the rent and, you know, makes it possible, then I think absolutely you should think about retiring. But like a lot of us go to college or some don't go to college, but we never really feel like we took advantage of what we learned in college. So there's so many opportunities for continuing to learn a new craft, to think about something that people said, hey, you know, you're really good at, you really have a good eye at designing. Have you ever thought about maybe doing something along those lines? Or how can you learn something new that would be interesting to you that would allow you to spend the time in a way that you would find meaningful? And if you're lucky, be able to make some money to be able to continue to survive in this world.
So in our culture, we worship youth. How does the Center for Longevity embrace aging? I was thinking about that interesting sort of interplay between aging well with your health, but there's also all of this pressure to like look young, stay young. How does your work contribute to sort of embracing our natural aging?
One thing about our Stanford Center of Longevity, I kind of consider one of the earliest in its time that it even had longevity in the title. So many other academic institutions have aging centers, healthy aging centers across the country, but this is really a longevity center that's not just medically and health focused, but focused across the spectrum of society. So for sure, there's interest in looking good. Let's optimize health spans. I think a lot of people are interested and they hear longevity and go, oh, it must be about how can we look young forever. I think that one of Laura's big contributions, I mean, it's not like she went into this and had this idea, aging is a net positive. It was really her research as a psychologist, where she did the seminal studies that kind of reported that people as they get older seem to report getting happier. You know, her study has since been, her findings have been replicated by other people at separate institutions and over 340,000 people from the UK. It does tend to be this, right? And so people are like, whoa, wait a minute. How can older people be happier? They're turning gray, they're getting wrinkled, they can't do the things that they used to do, just slower, whatever. So I think she spent her career really studying this in addition to running this longevity center. But what her subsequent research showed, like, why is that the case? It's because I think older people also realize time horizons in a different way than younger people. For example, one study she did was ask people of different ages, if you could only have dinner with someone, who would you choose? And older people would focus on likely people who they already knew, who were important to them, to really solidify those meaningful relationships. Where if they were younger, say college age, they would be more likely to explore. Well, why wouldn't I want to have a conversation with this amazing so-and-so who's known for this to learn and expand their horizon? So as we age, we see the time horizon, and that makes us be able to, I think, make choices about focusing on the now and what's important to us now, as opposed to thinking like we have endless time left. So I think it's more just kind of reframing how we think about it. Yes, there are losses. Anybody, all my patients who are over the age 90, all of them have had some major challenges, whether they be personal, whether they be health challenges, whether they be emotional challenges, definitely losses. Most of them have lost most of their friends. Some of them have lost their own children or even grandchildren, which is devastating. I think it doesn't make sense in our minds that our children should go before we do. All of these things. So I think at our center, we really think about, yes, there are challenges of getting older, but there are also all these benefits. And the fact of the matter is now in 2026, our demographic, we all hear, oh, it's the aging society, everybody's so old, and there are going to be so many old people compared to young people, which is all true, but it's actually even. We're going to find about the same number of people across time. When you think about that, how prepared are we as a society? In the 1935, when Perkins came up with Social Security, it made sense because people should retire around age 63, 65, and then their life expectancy wasn't that much more. The system, the government could pay them so that they could enjoy the rest of their lives. That model is not working anymore because there are just way too many older people for the younger people to support in this system. So the Stanford Longevity Center is thinking about, okay, how can we change institutions to better understand this? Same idea with education. Why is all our education completed by the time we're maybe 18 or if you're lucky, 22? Does that make sense? Does this model of education really work for a society that potentially is going to live 100 years? Should we reframe how we're thinking about how we educate people? Should we more broadly be thinking about finances? Because we know that happiness, for instance, we all say we want to be happy as we get older. To be happy, you need some basic necessities. You have to not be hungry. You should have a place to live and feel safe. You want to have a certain amount of freedom and flexibility. But beyond that, all those extra things, they don't contribute to more happiness. I know like lottery winner studies have shown this kind of thing. Like you think, oh, all I need is more money and I'll be more happy. That is just not a truth, unfortunately or fortunately.
Do you personally feel happier as you grow older?
Yes. Isn't that crazy? I said that without even thinking. I feel so lucky because, especially because I get to teach just amazing students, but I see where they are. And the studies have also shown this. To be in your 20s is totally stressful. If we're talking about stress, there's so many uncertainties, you know, and yet now I've been there and I've done so many things and they can't believe it. And I said, wow, I guess that it wasn't like it wasn't stressful all along because I definitely had stresses for sure. I had a lot of challenges, but now I can feel at peace with that. Like, okay, well, I survived. You know, look, I can't complain. I'm here talking to you.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to ask you a question I ask all my guests. And that is, what does a peaceful exit mean to you?
I think it is true as you get older, death seems closer just because you start losing people who are meaningful to you and you see things happen. I think I've lost two good high school friends, for example, already. So peaceful exit for me is basically knowing that when my time comes, that I'm okay with how things are and that having the people who do care about me and love me, feeling confident that they're going to be okay, but also having confidence in knowing that I'm okay. That would be a peaceful exit.
Thank you for listening to Peaceful Exit. I'm your host, Sarah Cavanaugh. You can find us on Instagram at A Peaceful Exit and on YouTube at Peaceful Exit Podcast. To learn more about this podcast and my work, please visit peacefulexit.net. You can also send us an email and let us know what you thought of this episode or share an idea for a new episode. We're at peacefulexitpodcast@gmail.com. Our senior producer is Julie Canfer, and our sound engineer is Jason Gambrill. Additional support from Cindy Gall and Sierra Austin. I have an amazing team. Original music provided by Ricardo Russell. Please make sure to follow us on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts and rate and review us wherever you listen. It really makes a difference. And please tell your friends about Peaceful Exit. As always, thank you for listening.